I love about these chats, now I've listened to the podcast, I realise that there'll be a little exchange from this little bit that'll happen.
It won't be this bit.
Oh, dear.
This is the Living Spit Podcast. Welcome to the Living Spit Podcast. Listen to the Living Spit Podcast. It's on the way.
Hello and welcome to episode 4 of the Living Spit Podcast. Hello, Howard.
Hello, Stu. I've got to say, because of the various technology involved in recording this, I've never actually seen your face when you do that hello at the beginning. I've got it all set up tonight so I can actually see you while we're recording
this.
Oh,
can you?
Yeah, yeah.
I could see you if I choose. I've just put the face. Oh, there you are. I see you now.
So it's just hysterical because of the you do a proper kind of Terry Wogan stroke Ken Bruce face, which I love.
Hello, the Living Spit Podcast.
Don't do your Terry Wogan.
No, that was watching my Ken Bruce, but never mind. Yeah, the Living Quiz put paid to my Terry Wogan impression. It didn't go down well, did it? Everyone was very angry when they couldn't guess who it was.
We had a few of those, didn't we, to be honest? We had my Sarah Millican. Nobody ever knew that, did they?
No, and they got really annoyed.
I hold with the fact that that's a really good impression. But your Kermit the Frog always went down well.
Oh, it did. It did go down well, yeah.
And, and my Alan Rickman.
Your Alan Rickman went on for about 4 hours because the huge pause you left in between.
Well, that's what he used to do.
That's what he used to do, yeah.
Dead now, of course.
Dead now, of course. Well, you might hear more about that, listener, on our Living Quiz episode, should there be one.
Who knows?
I mean, if the demand's there.
Yeah, we might, actually.
We don't know. If the demand's there, maybe. But I'll be honest with you, Howard, there's been fewer downloads this week than there were
last week,
or the week before. So it's dropping off. But we'll still do it, won't we? We'll still be here, even if there's only one listener.
Well, if it was just us, because let's face it, we've got nothing else to do.
It'd be us and Graham Gale in Winterbourne Stickland with his wireless next to him.
Does he listen, does he, Graham?
I don't know. He always comments on the stuff, so I'm guessing he must listen.
Well, if you are listening, Graham, hello. We've also got a special hello we need to say today to this a couple that I need to do actually. The first one is to our brother-in-law Tim, who listened for the first time today and contacted us via our little family WhatsApp group. The first one was just listen to your podcast. It was really good, and then slightly later he put that sounded a bit sincere. It was rubbish.
That's classic Tim.
And the other big hello, I mean, I almost certainly he doesn't listen to this, our friend really, Neil James, it's his 50th birthday today. We're recording this on a Monday, Easter Monday. Happy birthday.
Happy birthday, Neil.
Yes.
50 years young, 50, Neil James.
Unbelievable, didn't it?
Who'd have thunk it?
Yeah. Well, happy Easter, everyone.
Happy Easter,
I hope you've been enjoying your Easter in your quarantined existence. Now, if you're listening to this months or even years later, we're recording this right in the middle of the coronavirus pandemic. So that's the various references to being quarantined are due to that.
Quarantined, and lockdown. How are we doing? How are you coping with lockdown at the moment, Howard? Well, how is your quarantine going?
Do you know what? I was just saying, actually, before we came sort of on air, as it were, actually, I've been a bit fed up today, to be honest, Stu. It comes in waves, doesn't it? That's what I find. Well, it does for me.
How have you been? Why have you been fed up?
I don't know.
I've
had loads of projects, and now they're not there anymore, and we're kind of just hanging around the house a lot. And there's still loads to do, but I'm sure it'll be okay. And hopefully, we're getting towards hitting the peak, and we can all think about what's going to happen next. How about you? How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm okay. Again, like you, I've had a few projects to do, and they've kind of dwindled now. I was working on all the music for Frankenstein, and I was very excited about that, but now I just hope Frankenstein is going to happen now. So I've kind of stopped it just in case it doesn't, really. Uh-huh. But that's a silly reason to stop. I will carry back on with it. But I'll tell you what, this podcast has really helped, actually.
I agree.
I always know when Monday is because we record it.
That's right.
It sort of marks the week, really. I go, oh, Monday's here again.
We have got a bit of writing to do, haven't we?
That's true.
We've got to write a Christmas show at some point. So, but presumably, well, I don't know, we'll talk about this off air, as it
off
were.
Off air.
but we are going to be writing our Christmas show. Can we announce what that's going to be?
No, let's not. Let's tease it a little bit. Yeah, we're going to be doing a Christmas show, listeners. And we're supposed to be writing it right now. But, yeah.
Well, to be fair, we weren't writing it right now because we are supposed to be... we're on holiday at the moment, aren't we? We're on, officially in our 2 weeks holiday.
Easter holidays.
Yeah, so maybe next week we'll get down to something. Maybe we won't. Who knows?
Yes. We were supposed to be carrying on with rehearsals next week, weren't we, for Elizabeth, which was going to be going out on tour this summer. But that's going to be postponed now and probably until next summer, I thought.
Yes, that's the plan anyway.
Anyway, but we're not here to talk about Elizabeth or our holidays, Howard.
No.
We're here to discuss, well, why don't you announce what it is we're here to discuss?
Well, given
this
that it is Easter Monday today, and Easter celebrates the end of our Lord Jesus Christ's life.
It certainly does.
And how he died for our sins. We thought we'd cast our mind back to, Christmas and do the show that marks the beginning of Jesus Christ's life, which was the Nativity.
The Nativity.
So that's what we're going to do today. I think a lot of people say it's their favourite show.
Is that right?
Well,
we find a lot, though, that people say their favourite show is the one they saw first. We've had a lot of people saying, oh, that's my favourite. And you say, oh, which do you see first? That one. Yeah, okay, right. That's
we
very
are.
Popular of you. But Nativity is a popular one, isn't it? We've done that a couple of years now.
Yeah, and we were desperate to do it again, but it sort of didn't happen, didn't it? So we will be doing it again, almost certainly, at some point in the future.
Yeah, we still want to give that a run.
Yeah, but the trouble is you can only really do it at Christmas.
Exactly.
It's a fatal flaw in a Christmas show.
Yeah.
So we've got a few comments from last week, haven't we?
Before we get down to business. You want to crack into them, or shall I do the first?
So Watsy123... via Podbean has said, brilliant as always, XX, can't wait to see you live very soon. Now, I assume, Watsy123, you meant to put very soon.
Yes, unless she's actually a cannibal and is saying, it's a misprint. She says, can't wait to see your liver soon.
Yeah, that's true.
Could be that.
Yeah.
She's Sarah Watts, I think so.
Oh, is it Sarah Watts, is it? Ah, right. I didn't know. I thought, how does he know that it's a woman? Is he party to some information that I am? I'm not. And, of course, it turns out you are.
Well, I don't know. Sarah, are you a cannibal? Do you want to see our liver soon or do you want to see us live very soon? Please comment and clarify your intentions. We've got Adam, also via the Podbean app. He says... I love Howard's End.
Now, there are three things he could be talking about here.
Yeah, go on.
One is the film from the late 80s, early 90s, starring...
it's a great film.
What's his name? Anthony Hopkins.
Anthony Hopkins.
It could be that.
Or number two.
Number two is, my penis.
But
I'm pretty sure I've never shown that to anybody called Adam.
No.
Well, not recently, anyway. Not so that they remember.
Well, number three, he could be talking about the item on this podcast at the end called Howard's End.
So we're assuming it's that. I think.
But you know what assume did, Howard, don't you? Peed his pants and thought he was swimming.
Adam, the good news is that that's coming up at the end of the podcast.
Your penis?
No.
Option three.
I don't know. I mean, I could do the penis thing, although nobody would see it.
Nobody would know either way. You could just do it for your own comfort if you enjoyed it.
Exactly.
Anyway.
Let's move on, shall we?
Yeah.
Okay. David Phillips, who's been a regular contributor, just a follow-up, he said he's checked his tetanus, is up to date, and so it's okay to bite stew when playing the asp.
Brilliant.
Good. Thanks, David. You know, David. This is never going to happen, don't you? I mean, you're getting quite excited about it. He's also put one of those crying with laughter emojis just to be sure that we understand that he's joking.
He is joking. I'm glad he put that because I would have taken him for serious.
Yeah.
But thank you, David. I'm glad you checked that tetanus and I'm ready to have you bite me, I suppose. Okay. Well, those are the comments and questions from last week. So why don't we delve in, Howard, to our version of the Nativity, or to give it its full title, Living Spit's Nativity, because it is very much our Nativity, isn't it?
Uh-huh.
And let's remember how it all kicked off with the birth of the mirth.
People ask us, where'd you get your ideas? Well, let us tell you lots of blood, sweat and tears. And now we'll tell you how we maintain these careers. For what it's worth, it's the birth of the mirth.
Okay, the jingle there for the birth.
Honestly, that jingle, brilliant.
It's like a fine wine, isn't it? It gets better every week with age. Just sort of ferments in our subconsciouses.
In many ways, it does.
In many, many ways. So, the Nativity, Howard, What was the birth of the mirth? What do you remember about how we got this idea to do the Nativity?
Well, we'd done Living Spit's Christmas Carol. That was our first Christmas show that we made. And we'd done it for 2 years running. And we kind of got the idea that it's quite nice to do our own Christmas show. Because up to that point, we'd always done Christmas shows for other people, hadn't we? We'd always...
That's right.
Throughout our whole careers, we'd done every Christmas, done a Christmas show, a panto or a Christmas show or something like that. So it was quite nice to be able to be at home and, you know, doing our own thing during Christmas. And we wanted to do another, like, classic Christmas story. We always like to do the sort of, in some ways, the obvious thing and then do something not obvious with it. I think that's what we like. We like a title that everybody knows or thinks they know and then do something different with it. So we thought, well, we've done Christmas Carol. What's the second most famous Christmas story ever told? So we thought we'd do the Nativity. And basically, we thought we'd never get away with it, didn't we?
No, but there's something about that appealed to us. The challenge of that, I vaguely recall. Us sitting and thinking, how would we get away with that? Let's try it and see if we can. And we barely did.
Yeah.
We'll get into that, won't we? There's a bit of controversy around it. So that was where the idea came from. And I remember us sitting in the lounge, not Coffee One this time, in Clevedon, because the lounge had come along by
then.
So we were spreading our wings and going to another coffee shop across the road. And we sat in there and we came up with the copy, didn't we, for the flyer.
I remember that, for the poster
and the flyer.
Yeah.
And I remember you writing, Living Spit take on the second greatest Christmas story ever told. And I thought that was really, really funny. And we started with a joke, didn't we? With something like... some lambs and some shepherds,
a
star in the sky, three wise men. But enough about what Howard's got you for Christmas.
Brilliant.
Which I really enjoyed.
Yeah. So by that point we were co-running the shop, weren't we? And I think we felt that it was really good for the theatre shop to have a Christmas show. Had they done the Nutcracker the year before?
I think they'd done Nutcracker the year before, yes, which was a sort of miniature ballet for families, but also with actors in it as well. And they had done that, and it was quite successful in terms of a Christmas show running in the shop over that season. So we thought, that would be a good thing to carry on.
So we thought, we'll do it in the shop. And, we did.
Yeah.
But we did a little tour as well, didn't we? We did... We toured with Arts Reach in Dorset and we toured...
We opened it in Salisbury, I remember.
Did we open it there?
We opened it at the Solberg, I think, in Salisbury, yeah.
Yeah, I do remember doing it in Salisbury, but yes. But anyway, that's moving on a bit. So the initial idea, wasn't it? I think we felt we wanted to do like a children's nativity, but for adults, didn't we?
Yeah,
so to make it as much like a children's nativity as possible, but do it for adults.
Absolutely. Well, there's something about that that's really appealing, that the kids wear, when they do the nativity, they wear kind of slightly crap costumes, obviously made by the mums and dads, kind of wings, cardboard wings covered in tin foil with a bit of tinsel around it, that sort of thing. And we thought that kind of makeshift idea fitted really well with our kind of aesthetic. So we thought, what better way to approach this than to use that? And also, everyone knows that kind of approach to the nativity, don't they?
That's right.
Children being the donkey and the... I've seen a child who played a lobster in the Nativity.
Brilliant.
I don't know what that was about, but that idea was the initial idea, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. And I remember, as always, writing a Christmas show, we were writing in like June.
Mm.
It's always, you're always writing it at the most inappropriate time.
Absolutely.
We were on tour, weren't we, with something, and we were writing it in the daytimes when we were doing the show in the evening.
We were in Dis.
We were in
the
Dis.
Show.
Yes.
In Dis.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we. Dis what?
We kept
can't resist it.
We kept going back to the same cafe, didn't we, and writing in there.
Yes,
together.
Yeah, that was a lovely little cafe, wasn't it?
Mm. There's a series of issues with the story, isn't there?
Oh yeah.
I mean, mainly that there isn't one nativity story. So I actually read the Bible.
Did you?
Yeah, I did.
The whole thing, only the...
No, only the bits that... Because we should say that Stu and I are both atheists. We're not...
Yeah.
Whilst we're raised in the Christian tradition, we're not Christians ourselves. But I think we never really... I mean, we'll talk about it more later, about controversy and stuff. We never really wanted to... It was really important to us that we didn't sort of take the mickey out of people's beliefs, I think, wasn't it?
Yes. I think it's the same with every story we approach. There are always kind of plot points in any story which are ridiculous. Mm. And we had no qualms about making fun of those.
Yes.
But what we didn't want to do was say, you're an idiot for believing in it, you know, because that's none of our business for a start. Yeah. It's certainly not Absolutely. Something we want to go out into the world saying. So yeah, we wanted to be reverent to the story in the sense that people take it very seriously and believe it, but irreverent in the sense that we could do what we want with it as well. I mean, the nativity is a strange one, isn't it? Because as children at school, you're kind of brought up with that story as fact. Mm-hmm. And that's taught to you in every Christmas. This is the Christmas story. So I don't know how you felt about this, Howard, but even as an atheist, I felt the certain part of this story is kind of owned by us because it's one we've been brought up being told. So I didn't feel like it was off limits for atheists.
No, absolutely. To tackle. You know, we're brought up in that tradition, so we're made to learn it. So it belongs to us as much as anybody. You may have said that, Stu, already. I didn't hear any of it.
Did I break up?
Yeah, you broke up. But
we should remind listeners that we are obviously in our respective homes again this week.
Yes,
talking over FaceTime and recording this over FaceTime. Other face-showing apps are available.
Yeah. So there was various the various issues, wasn't there? The various things that we... I mean, the first thing was you were planning your wedding, do you remember?
That's right. Yeah, I do.
And so the first thing we were sort of thinking about was how do we like treat this idea of Mary and Joseph, you know, this idea that she gets pregnant immaculately.
Yes.
And what would Joseph think about that? What's the, you know, that bringing the domestic into the divine, I suppose, that's the...
Absolutely.
That's what we were aiming to do. And it was kind of, well, hang on, she's got a bit of explaining to do, hasn't she? And so that was
she
our first
has.
Thing that we talked about.
Yeah, we read the Bible, didn't we? At least the two bits that were pertinent to what we were writing. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've ever read this... Listener, the nativity story in the Bible. There are two.
Yeah.
And I think it's one is Luke, and I think the other's Matthew. Is it Matthew?
Yes, I think so.
And they're very different versions. And
well, they've got different bits in them, haven't they?
They do. So the version we know is an amalgamation of both of those because
the wise men are in one and the shepherds are in the other.
That's right.
The massacre of the innocents is in one, but not in the other.
Yes, that's true. And in Luke, there's a very lengthy bit at the very beginning where Mary and Joseph's relationship is thrown into turmoil briefly when she tells Joseph the good news that she's immaculately conceived. And he's up in arms about it and says, well, you've obviously had an affair, haven't you? And wants to divorce her. And he goes to the temple, I believe.
Yes.
And God appears to him in a kind of vision. Or is it Gabriel? I think Gabriel appears to him via God. No, God appears to him via Gabriel, in a vision and says, no, don't divorce her. She's telling the truth. And he goes, really? He goes, yeah, go back home. It's all fine.
Yes, and we thought we'd play with that a bit. You know, we wrote a long scene for the... Well, not the opening, because the opening's with God and Gabriel. We'll talk about that in a sec.
Yeah.
The first scene, I remember we wrote this long scene about the table plan. They were planning the table plan, weren't they? Do you remember?
And I do.
And we'd named all the tables after... Books of the Bible, wasn't it?
Yes, that's right.
And it was so complicated that we junked it, didn't we? And you wrote that brilliant thing about cheese.
It was like, oh, Uncle Mike's on Deuteronomy and Auntie Jackie's on Exodus.
Yeah.
It had a germ of something in it, but it didn't really work because it was so many... we got this thing with Craig as well, our director. You'll have heard from him last week.
Yeah.
But he... Often, when we write lots of names into things, he's very hot on that.
Who's that? I don't understand it. I did the impression.
Too many names to keep up with, so he often says, too many names. So we heard that in our heads when we were writing it, him saying there's going to be too many names, so we thought we'd better get rid of that. Mm. What did we come up with instead?
Well, it was the cheese thing, wasn't it?
Oh, the cheese thing, that's
Yeah, you came up with that.
That was Joseph and Mary discussing their wedding cake, which was one of those trendy ones made out of cheese that people have these days.
Mm.
And he was on the phone, which was a banana, I think.
Yeah, no good reason.
No good reason. And then we do the classic reveal that it actually was a banana all along.
And he was just practicing.
He's practicing with a banana.
Oh, hysterical.
much mirth ensued.
So, but before that, and again, you came up with this. We always have a... Well, we don't always, but we often have a have a kind of frame, what they call a framing device, which is basically like, why are we telling this story? Mm. And it's often just me and you, isn't it, or versions yes. of us that are talking to the audience. But on this occasion, we came up with the idea of having God and Gabriel as and they were roughly our personalities.
Yeah,
but, so
were.
I was God and you were Gabriel, and there was a framing device of like, right, we're going to do this now because. Well, God was bored. Do you remember?
Yes.
We had that long conversation.
And he wanted a son. So he decided to create one.
Bored and lonely.
So this is the story. Imagine the conversation that God has had when he came up with this idea. Because it's such a preposterous idea. And if he can do anything, as he supposedly can, why impregnate a virgin from a very poor part of the world and make her travel? Why do all those things? Why not just bring a child into being if he can? And we wanted to just talk about why he decided to do that. So we wrote in some reasons for him. And it turns out he's just a bit of a control freak, really.
He's somebody who, and I think this is a bit of my personality too, somebody who's really good on the kind of general, but really bad on the specific. So...
yeah. And that was Gabriel's job. He was kind of the foil to God.
Yes,
sort of speaking the thoughts of what the audience must have been thinking.
Exactly.
Like, why are you doing that? And he'd say, well, don't bother me about the details, right? I'll work them out later. So, yeah, that was quite an interesting device to use to frame the whole thing in.
Yes. So, yeah, we did that. And then we kept going back to them, didn't we, to kind of... Again, it's a way of sort of taking us to a different place and...
Jumping out of the action.
So that was handy. So
they came in very handy at the end as well, I remember, because the nativity story doesn't really have much of an ending. It just kind of peters out.
That's right,
And so we went back to God and Gabriel for that, with God coming down to rescue his son, Jesus, from the clutches of the evil Herod.
Well, God literally saves the day, doesn't he?
He does.
In our version, God comes down and tells Herod off and sends him away, but doesn't kill him.
Doesn't kill him.
Interestingly.
Yeah. But Herod had to have his comeuppance, didn't he? Because he's such a nasty piece of work in our version. So
yes,
he had to have his comeuppance somehow.
Well, let's talk about Herod because we're there now. So I remember we were in this cafe, weren't we? In Dis.
Dis what?
every time.
Can't resist it.
And we came up with this idea that Herod was like a northern comic, although he doesn't tell jokes, but he's just like. Sort of like Bernard Manning, but without the jokes.
Exactly. Bernard Manning was was our kind of reference.
Yeah.
I remember watching a lot of YouTube clips of Bernard Manning.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you've ever watched Bernard Manning, listeners, but he is obviously fairly racist and offensive. But occasionally you do get a really good, just classic joke. Like my favourite was the Quasimodo one. Can I tell that one?
You can if you like.
Quasimodo goes into a bar and the barber says, what are you having? He says, whiskey, please. He says, bells, all right. He says, mind your fucking business.
I love that. Yeah, it's a good joke.
Yeah.
But we kind of, basically, it's how do you take the idea of a villain to the nth degree and make him a real arsehole? And so, a sort of comedy arsehole, really.
Yes.
And also, like, what do people not expect in a nativity, which is somebody swearing, you know,
it is every other word.
It was every other word. So we just made him swear as much as we could.
Yes,
which makes us laugh. I mean, swearing makes me laugh, Stu.
We have touched on this before, haven't we? No, it's not. I don't think it is sad. I think Billy Connolly talks about swearing a lot and how it's very funny. It's just
it is funny.
It's a strange thing, isn't it? Because comedy is so subjective. But I find swearing very funny when used. What's the word? When used in the right place,
absolutely.
In the right context, the right word is hysterical.
Yeah.
It's really, really funny. And if you can get that right, then it doesn't seem gratuitous.
Yeah, and Herod's this kind of, like, he's a man with high blood pressure, isn't he? I mean, he's a proper kind of, like, red-faced, angry man, you know?
He is.
Why else would you... instigate the massacre of the innocents unless you were just really paranoid, you know?
And
so that's where it comes from. And he's just really angry and a really good way of expressing anger in a character in a funny way is to make them swear a lot. So that's...
Yes,
that's where it
makes him quite impotent as well. Like, he's got so much rage and he doesn't know what to do with it. So he just, we all know people that just, they swear too much, and you can't listen to them because it's like, oh, it just sounds empty now. Your swearing sounds empty. Yeah, so you overuse it. And he's one of those. There's so much rage and anger that he just kind of overuses it, and it loses all meaning. And he's very angry about the fact he lives near a service station, and the wise men think that they can buy snack foods from him, and that's just...
Where did that come from? I've got no idea where that came from.
So we did this song, the wise men sing, "We three kings of Orient are."
Yeah.
Except there's only two of them, obviously, because it's only Howard and myself. So we wrote in that Balthazar was in the car waiting, which made us think, well, they're on a journey up the M6 or something, aren't they?
Exactly.
They're off in the car to find this baby. And they'd stopped for a wee at what they thought was a service station and then found Herod's palace. So we kind of thought, well, he must live near a service station. And then he's probably really annoyed that travellers keep coming in asking for a grab bag of Watsits.
That's right, yeah. Well, probably this is a good time to bring in the wise men. Now, this was interesting, wasn't it? We wrote the wise men, and we sort of wrote this really weird thing where when they spoke to each other, they spoke to each other normally, but when they spoke to anybody else, they spoke in a sort of highfalutin Shakespearean way, didn't they?
Yes, like a flowery language that they...
And, well, we did it in rehearsal, and it sort of just... didn't really work, did it?
No, it died on its arse as well.
It did.
It just didn't really go anywhere, did it? I mean, what was the joke? That they didn't feel that they could be posh in front of each other or in front of people in the public? We just basically had written it in and not given it much thought, so...
Yes, so, and Craig, bless him, as he does, said, it doesn't work. So I remember we rewrote it in rehearsals, didn't we? And we
That's
made
right.
them into these kind of... Because at the time, they weren't those kind of Sloan Ranger-y types, were they?
No.
That they ended up being... And, we ended up rewriting it into, like, these kind of, like, two guys, you know, like... And of course, I had this straight blonde wig.
Yes.
And this was just about at the time of the sort of big rise of our esteemed, if those are your political affiliations, leader, Boris Johnson. And I'm sort of the similar sort of size to Boris Johnson, aren't I? And I looked a bit like Boris Johnson.
Hey, there's a show in that maybe, Howard, the Boris Johnson story.
It seemed terribly sort of, like politically satirical, didn't it? But
yes.
The truth was we just had two blonde wigs.
And it came from improvisation, I think. I remember you getting the script and we'd written this flowery sort of language for you.
Yeah.
And I think you said, I'm just going to try something else with it. I'm just going to try, like, rephrasing this slightly in a different voice. And Craig went, yeah, go for it. And and that's what came out. You did that kind of, oh, hi, where are we? And I remember it felt like a real breakthrough in rehearsals.
Yeah.
We were like, yes, we finally got them. And I remember Craig standing up going, that's it, that's the wise men, yes, they speak like that. So, it was a real eureka moment when we found that.
Thank God.
Yeah. I also remember you were much better, I think. I remember feeling a bit, oh, God, I haven't quite got that yet.
Right.
It was just so natural to you, because I don't know if you know people like that, but I don't really, and I'd never really watched things like Made in Chelsea, so, but I really wanted to be as good as you in it. I remember thinking, I've got to be as good as Howard. I've got to match him. It kind of keeps you on your toes, doesn't it, really? I mean, it keeps you trying to do your best stuff all the time, which is quite... But I remember those were brilliant, those two. And what about the shepherds?
The shepherds. Oh, the shepherds. When we did Elizabeth the first time, when we first wrote it, this is, I'm not going off topic here, we'd written a character of John Dee. It was this kind of magician bloke. And I was playing him, and I don't know why I just started doing this voice like this, you see. And they played it like this absent-minded old fella, you know, like that sort of thing. It was sort of loosely based on a story my dad had... I'm not going to tell the story now, but...
Walt Arrell.
A guy. Yeah. We'd never heard him speak, and he probably didn't speak like that, but we just imagined him speaking so we did that, and then the scene got cut, so the character was just wasted, basically. Totally wasted.
Can I just say... Jimmy, just intervene and say, one of the reasons it got cut, listeners, but Howard, every time he came on for that scene, I was stood on stage and I'd summoned John Dee in to talk to me, and he came on and he pointed his head off stage to an imaginary person and had an up to 15-minute conversation with that person. So he'd go, yeah, no, I told her that, but No, well, you try and tell her. And he'd do it for about 15 minutes. And I'd stand waiting. And then eventually, when he felt like the scene could continue, he'd look at me and go, hello. And that was his indication that his improvisation was done and he was ready to get back on script. So that was one of the reasons, maybe, that he got cut.
Well, anyway, but it was cut and we lost the character. And so we had this... I remember we were in Dis again, I think. Go on, do it.
Dis what?
Thank you. We were in a different cafe and we were writing this scene and we had this idea of counting sheep. What do shepherds do all day? Well, they count sheep, but don't they? And mm-hmm. and counting sheep makes you go to sleep. Because we knew that they had to have this dream, didn't we? Because we'd had three scenes where Gabriel had come down, given some information and gone back up again. We thought, we can't do that again because it's really boring. So we had this idea that one of them was the granddad and the other one was his grandson and he was teaching him how to be a shepherd and that the only thing involved in being a shepherd was counting sheep. But, of course, when granddad tried to count the sheep, he fell asleep.
Such a simple idea.
But whilst he was asleep, he had the vision. So that's how that scene came about. And that scene was... Well, that was probably the most improvised scene we've ever
Without
done.
Without a doubt. Well, we had these characters, these ridiculous... We spoke like that. And we'd get such good reactions from the audience that we just milk it and just, like, make it... It got bigger every night and the pauses got bigger. And I just remember that scene, just looking forward to it. And then when it was over... I was going, I want to do the shepherds again. They were brilliant. They only played a very small part, didn't they? Only one scene.
Two scenes.
Yeah, it was two little scenes, that's right. Yeah.
But we don't normally improvise. People always ask us, don't they? They always say, oh, you probably improvise. And we never do. But that scene, we would just milk it and improvise it. We'd corpse as well. Corpsing, yes. if you don't know what that means, it means just laughing when you're not supposed to be laughing. And we discovered that the audiences just sort of loved that. So we just sort of let it happen, didn't we? We never forced it. But if it happened, we didn't sort of suppress it, did we?
There was a bit when... I remember when I had to ask you a question, like, really? Yeah. And you said, your line in the script was, yeah. Right? So the lines go, really? Yeah. And I would go, really? And you go, oh, yeah. And then wait while there's a big, huge laugh. And you go, yeah. And another one. And then occasionally you'd go, one more. Yeah. To do a third or a fourth or a fifth even. But we'd only ever do it while it was still funny. And then we'd... Because I think we instinctively know, don't we, with all our years of training and impro and stuff that we've done, when to stop milking a gag.
Yeah.
Well, maybe not. Maybe, listeners, you can tell us whether we've mastered that skill or not. But I think we kind of know. So we'd always know to when we'd done it enough. Mm. But yeah, it had them in stitches, that scene,
didn't it? That was great. Yeah, and let's talk about the gifts. So we had these gifts.
Oh, yes.
And they were, most of them were quite simple, really, weren't they? They were wrapped up gifts, and Trimo, our amazing stage manager, made us some brilliant gifts. One of them, at least one of them, was coffee cup.
Wrapped up.
But there was this one particular... We needed a button on the end of a scene, didn't we? Because everybody brings a gift. All the three wise men and the shepherds bring a gift. And Granddad Shepherd brings a bit of sheep shit, doesn't he? Because obviously that's all they've got. And he says, well, it's a paperweight.
Yes.
The person receiving it says, well, it looks like a lump of sheep shit. And he says, well, it is, but I thought you could use it as a paperweight.
Exactly.
And then there was the end of this scene was like, we didn't quite know how to end it, did we? It was kind of like, so we needed some kind of something to top all the other gifts, didn't we?
Yep.
And we had this idea that he'd knitted him, because obviously they're shepherds, so they've got access to wool, that he'd knitted him a hat, the little baby Jesus a hat. But we thought, well, you can't just knit him a hat. So we had this idea that he knitted him a hat with a cock and balls on it.
Yes.
Knitted into it.
Yes.
But the best thing about this was, now we've talked about Trimo, our stage manager's knitting skills in the last episode. Yep. She knitted the amazing balaclava for Judy, the cow in One Man and His Cow. But when we said to her, can you knit a baby's hat, but with a cock and balls on it. That was one of the strangest props she's ever had to make, I imagine.
And the best thing was her ringing up going, right, do you want the balls at the front and the cock behind, like a drawing, or do you want it to be realistic balls and cock? And that conversation was just brilliant to have with her. It's the sort of the reason we started this company, to have conversations like that with a dead straight face. Absolutely. And go, yeah, I think it needs to be two testicles and then a long phallus just behind poking up. Is that right? Yeah, in pink? Yes, please, in pink. But she came up with this brilliant, didn't she? This brilliant... Yeah. Cock and balls on a hat.
What about the Massacre of the Innocents?
Yes, so, the Massacre of the Innocents. Well, I don't remember how we came upon this idea, do you?
I remember seeing a show at the Watermill. And no, yeah, it wasn't. I was in a show at the Watermill. And we, Toby Hulse wrote it, brilliant Toby Hulse, and he'd ended it with the audience throwing stones at the actors. They were real stones, obviously. They were right, bits of foam rubber. And I just remember it was a kids' show, it was a Christmas show, and the kids just loved it, you know what I mean? Just getting the audience to throw things at the actors. They absolutely love that. So so I had this idea that we could get the, because we knew it was going to be an adult audience, we could get the audience to break apart some babies and get them to help with the Massacre of the Innocents, pull the dolls apart, and then throw the bits of doll at you as Herod.
Yeah, into a bucket. I was holding
a bucket. That's right.
That's right. Yeah.
So that's sort of what we did, and it was. Yeah. Well, it went really well. People said afterwards, didn't they? They said, oh, you know, I felt really uncomfortable, but I still did it.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting insight into people's psychology.
Well, it's a kind of mob rule, sort of a mob mentality, isn't it? That you look around and go, well, everyone else seems to be okay with it, so I guess I'll do it. And I think everyone's thinking that, so it happens almost without exception. There were a few people who said, oh, I didn't do that because I had a response ready for that. I'd say, it's just a doll, love. Look, it's plastic. And I'd like smack it on the head.
Yeah.
But yeah, there were a few people who were uncomfortable, but most of the time, everyone just went for it. Yeah. And it was a brilliant theatrical moment. There were dolls flying through the air, legs and arms and heads at this bucket, and a great moment. Wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, well, I don't want to preempt some questions that are coming at the end of the show.
There is quite a lot of questions about that moment.
I think we'll probably leave it there, and then we'll come back to the Massacre of the Innocents later.
Yes.
Is there any more of the plot that we need to cover? The innkeeper.
The innkeeper. What happened with that? How did you get that? Because that was your writing, wasn't it? The innkeeper.
Yeah, we had this idea that we knew that the there's always a joke, and we'd done it in this show before. With obviously, there's three wise men, and there's only two of us, and that is a constant problem and joke in our shows, that there aren't enough actors to play all the parts, because obviously, basically, a scene can only have two people in it, and so we play with various ways of doing that. Sometimes we use puppets, sometimes we just ignore the fact that there should be more people in the scene, sometimes we play all the parts at once, but I love the idea of when you have an offstage character. We have a character off stage, and we do it with the three wise men, but we also did it with the innkeeper, didn't we? We
had
Joseph arrives, and the innkeeper has to confer with his wife whether there's any room. So he keeps shouting off backstage, doesn't he?
Jan!
She was called Jan, wasn't she? And only because it's a funny, in that voice, it's a funny, you know, Jan! 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 You know,
Jan!
And then we realised that we've got some very dear friends who help at the theatre shop, and she's called Jan and he's called Rod, and so they became Jan and Rod.
Jan and Rod. You wore a little name tag, didn't
you?
Saying happy to help. Rod.
Yeah. So that's how we did them. What else? Oh, the nappy changing scene. Do you remember?
Oh, yes, I do remember.
We thought
that.
Well, as it's Christmas, we ought to follow some of the panto rules, didn't we?
Yes.
So the Massacre of the Innocents was a sort of panto thing of getting the audience involved, but also we thought, well, what does a panto rules as a sort of slapstick slosh, what they call a slosh scene, which is generally no words, and people get covered in, you know, gunk. So we did the nappy changing as a sort of slosh scene, didn't we?
Yes, we did. And it was Craig's... I remember we just wrote in the script, they perform a hilarious nappy changing routine.
Yeah, that's
right. And we thought, well, Craig, we'll do that with Craig in rehearsals. And he came up trumps, didn't he? He came up with a really good routine.
He did.
And he choreographed
Brilliant.
It all. And it was great. We gave a dirty nappy to a member of the audience with... There was coffee grounds in it, all smushed in with a teaspoon that made it look like shit. And they'd always go, oh, God, no. If only they'd smelled it, they'd go, that's coffee. I'm not worried.
Exactly. But weirdly, they didn't ever smell it, did they?
They never did smell it. They always tried to pass it back. So that was a fun little routine. And we covered him in, what was it, like Johnson's baby powder and
cream, pseudocreme.
Oh, your pseudocreme.
Oh, God, it was a nightmare. It got everywhere, didn't it? There we are.
Yes, so at the end of the show, there was a lot of mess to clean up.
There were, yeah.
Why don't we stop, pause there and play a little song?
Yes, why not?
And then we'll come back and talk about the controversy, shall
yes,
we?
Yes, let's do that.
The songs, we had this idea that the songs in the show would be traditional Christmas songs and carols, but we'd put alternative lyrics to them. Because we wanted it, as Howard said earlier, we wanted it to have that feel of a child's nativity at school. And they sing carols, don't they? They sing Away in a Manger and they sing Little Donkey, all that stuff. So we thought, well, let's keep those tunes that people know so well and let's do some different lyrics. Dirty if poss.
Yes, and it also saved us writing any tunes.
It certainly did.
So my particular favourite was the giving birth to the tune of Away in a Manger.
Yes.
The baby is coming.
It was the baby is coming. My legs are now spread.
The little Lord Jesus. And you say, I can see his sweet head.
I can see his sweet head because I was down the business end as Joseph, while Howard as Mary simulated giving birth to the baby Jesus. But this one is, we're going to play O Little Town of Bethlehem.
Featuring Stuart McLaughlin on the banjo and myself on the coconut halves.
Little town of Bethlehem, it's Joseph's place of birth. His father was a civil engineer who looked like Colin Firth. My mother worked in Wetherspoons, she fixed the slot machines. In that shitty town of Bethlehem, Judea's Milton Keynes. Oh, little town of Bethlehem, that's where we've set our course. I'm riding on a donkey, we can't afford a horse. I would have liked a camel to smooth out all the bumps. I'd make a chair out of its pair of furry fatty humps. Oh, little town of Bethlehem, towards you now we draw. My feet are sore and blistered, my arse is rubbed red raw. My waters have just broken. A B&B, we're in luck. They're sure to have a room or two. No vacancies. Oh, fuck.
Great.
So there we go. Okay. And that is available, Howard, I should say, for download.
Yes.
Or purchase of audio compact disc. on our compilation, Living Spits Greatest Spits, which is available via our website.
Yeah, so you can get that on livingspit.co.uk/shop.
Yeah. What else do we want to talk about? The Hallelujah ending.
Oh,
I'd like
yes.
to discuss as
yes.
well.
Now, yes. This was your idea.
It was. So years ago, 2005, I was in a show called Quorum Boy. And the end of that show, the big, there was about 30 people in the company of this show. And the curtain call, it was a Christmas show. And we'd walk downstage and we all sang the Hallelujah chorus to great delight and much appreciation from the audience. At which point, you guaranteed basically a standing ovation, whatever the show's been like. Because you're singing the Hallelujah chorus in four-part harmony, the whole thing. So we'd learnt that and it took us a long time to learn it. And then we performed it at the end of the show. So cut to us writing this show, and I thought, wouldn't it be great to do that again, to sing the Hallelujah chorus? And I remember it was received in a fairly lukewarm way from both yourself and Craig, well, because it meant a lot of work, a lot of learning
yeah,
had to happen.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I surpassed all expectations, if I remember rightly.
You certainly
now,
did.
I'm known not to be very good at learning stuff. So, yeah, often I'm kind of not quite there until, you know, quite close to the first performance. But I thought, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to sit. And so I spent two nights, I think, learning that, this, my parts, and then came in the next day, we rehearsed it, and I remember going, yeah, I think I've got somewhere, and I did it all the way through, and you were like, oh my God, yeah, that's brilliant.
Yeah, you were better than me. Like, I got lost in the middle, because you can easily get lost, especially when you've done what we did, which was conflate four separate yes. singing parts into two. Mm. So there were moments when Howard was singing the tenor line, followed immediately by the soprano line, and then going to the baritone. And same for me. We were just jumping all over the place because of the arrangement that we'd done. So it was quite complicated, and you just kind of came in and nailed it, really. And I was like, oh, shit, I better step up my game here. So it was a lot to learn, but thankfully, thanks to that sort of that quick learning, we got there
yeah.
fairly quickly.
And do you remember, originally, it was we were doing it with the original Latin lyrics, weren't we?
And yes,
we did it, and yeah. Craig just went, he did that thing where he strokes his cheek yeah. and goes, you think, all yeah. right, something's coming here. And he said, it's just weird because yeah. you've rewritten the lyrics to all the others and you haven't really... So we went upstairs and we wrote new lyrics for it, didn't
yep.
we?
The yes, three of we us. Did. And the theme of it all was about, we made it that the song was going on forever and that we weren't ending it quickly yep. enough. And that was a nice little joke to end on. So he was bang on with that.
Yeah,
otherwise, we'd have done
again.
It with the proper Latin lyrics. And
yes.
Once again, Craig made our shows that little bit funnier, which is what he does best.
Yeah.
Well, I say best. He does other things, doesn't he?
Yeah. He's very good at doing... At the moment, he's recreating with his partner, Katie, famous yep. album covers and sending them to us on WhatsApp. So he does that as well.
Yes. So today he did... a Paul Simon solo album, and then he and I think it was Katie
yeah.
recreated the cover of a White Stripes
yeah.
album.
Brilliant. So controversy. I think we probably need to move
yes.
on to that. We play in this in a place called Sturminster Newton in Dorset. They, you know, the people are really lovely to us there. Brilliant team there that look after us, and we get a phone call. While we were in rehearsals.
I think it was.
And it had gone on yep. sale and they'd sold a lot of tickets and we'd put another night in, I think, hadn't we?
Yeah.
We'd added an extra night, so it was going really well. And suddenly we get this phone call saying basically that there'd been letters of complaint. I'll let you take up the story, Stu, because you sort of dealt with this.
I did. I rang Sharon, lovely Sharon and Karen, who run the exchange in Sturminster Newton. Darren or Aaron weren't available that day,
no.
So I spoke to Sharon, I think, and Sharon said, we've had a letter from a vicar. She said, I'll send it to you. And the gist of the letter was saying, how dare you run this vile filth, these idiots making fun of our Lord and Saviour Jesus Christ.
Bear in mind, at this point, we hadn't even rehearsed the show, so we
no.
didn't know how he knew what it was going to be like.
Yeah.
I have no idea, because we didn't
no.
even know what it was going to be like at
no,
that point.
No, we didn't have a clue what it was going to be. So, yeah, I guess he'd taken one look at our poster, which is of our faces superimposed over the classic nativity scene, and thought, well, this is going to be a piss take of All That I Find Holy. Either way, he was up in arms, so he'd written to them and demanded that they pull the show from sale and not sell it. And I said to Sharon, well, what are you going to do? Are you going to pull it? She said, no, of course I'm not going to pull it. It's just one person's opinion. Mm. And I said, okay, fine. She said, well, we'll let you know if there's any further movement. So we put the phone down. And I remember we were in rehearsals, weren't we? And we had just rehearsed at that moment Away in a Manger, which at that time had Howard on a bale of hay, legs akimbo, and the baby Jesus at that point catapulted from Howard's vagina across the stage and landed in my arms. I remember us going, is that a bit much now, do you think? And we all went, oh, I think that might be a bit much now. But we also had a bigger, deeper conversation, which it was, should we be doing this at all? And it was fairly late into, I mean, started rehearsals, so it would be difficult to pull the show at that point. But we considered it, didn't we?
Yeah, well, we talked about it, definitely. I mean, we did. You know, is this the wrong thing to do? Are we taking the mickey out of people's, you know, views that we don't hold, but that are strongly held by other people?
Yes.
I mean, with hindsight, it was totally not worth worrying about, was it?
Well, the day crept forward that we were going to the exchange to perform this show, and we were very scared. And Sharon had called us a couple of times in between that time, in the interim, to say the religious groups are building in number, and they're beginning to say that they'll kind of stand there and picket the thing, and, you know, tell people not to come in the doors as they come in. And so we're a bit worried about that. We expected a load of kind of God botherers with placards and flamed torches and things like that. But it turns out when we got there, there was one woman handing out pamphlets.
And they'd actually like hired in like festival crash fencing, hadn't they, and everything.
That's
they
right.
Really thought that it was going to be a big deal, and nothing happened.
Yeah.
And then we had that lovely card from Rev Nev, who's our he's the chaplain of the theatres in Bristol, was the chaplain of the theatres in Bristol, a brilliant friend to theatre in Bristol, and he sent us this lovely card, basically saying, it's the most accurate telling of the nativity he'd ever seen, which was so sweet from an actual real-life vicar that made us feel a lot better about the whole thing.
Yeah, because it was our version of having a kind of papal blessing, wasn't it? Really?
Yeah, I mean, and you know, to be fair, like we said at the beginning, we the idea wasn't to take the mickey out of it. The idea was to tell the story and to point up the inconsistencies in it if there were any, which there are. And I think even the most devout people would have to agree that there are inconsistencies, and,
absolutely,
you know, that's what makes it magical and mystical to them. And, you know, so that was our idea. And I think, you know,
but we came up with this idea, I remember, to sweeten the pill a little bit. Because we were so worried about the controversy, we thought, well, wouldn't it be great if the people that were telling people not to come and see the show were actually talking to a load of Marys and Josephs and donkeys and shepherds? So we encouraged our audience to dress up for the occasion.
That's right. We had a competition.
We did. We ran a competition that every night at the curtain call, we would select the person's costume that we thought was the best, and we'd give them a little prize. And what was the prize? It was a little bit of chocolate from
indulgence.
Yep. And everyone got a chance to dress up, and it meant that we were all as stupid and irreligious as each other. So
and you know what? Most people who hold religious beliefs that I know are pretty relaxed about all that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's, you know, most people aren't offended by these things. They accept it in the way that it's been intended, which is, I mean, you know, it's got to be, your faith's got to be pretty, not very robust if you're offended by
that
kind
of thing.
Yeah,
I think so.
I mean,
you know, I know lots and lots of religious people who are very open about what they believe, and they always are up for talking and debating about these things. And there's just, like all things, there's just a few people who ruin it for others.
But right, I think we've got there now, Stu, haven't we, on that on the nativity.
We've
so
got there.
Why don't we have some questions from the audience?
Another audience questions.
Okay, well, I've got one here, Howard. Now, this one is from a couple of weeks ago, and we neglected to read it out. But I was looking back over the archives, and I found this one from the wonderful Philip Naylor.
Yeah.
Who did you find funny as kids, and what did you want to be when you grew up?
Right.
That's a very interesting question.
It's a very
question,
interesting
isn't it?
Question.
So,
it's so obvious to say this if you're my age, but I am, of course, Morecambe and Wise.
Yeah.
But also, I remember loving The Young Ones. I was the right age for The Young Ones and Blackadder. Who else? I'm just trying to think. I mean, the obvious is the Monty Python. I actually didn't find Monty Python that funny at the time. I do now. I get, sort of get it now, but not at the time. But later on, we both share a love of the League of Gentlemen.
Oh, yes, definitely.
In adulthood.
Yes. Well, I used to love watching Spitting Image.
Yes.
I remember that being... I looked forward to that so much. And because there it was so much politics in it, and I was very, very young, I was a boy, I didn't understand those references, but puppets speaking in funny voices were very funny to me.
Yeah,
And I just loved watching it.
Yeah.
Again, like Howard, Morecambe and Wise was brilliant. I mean, it was kind of before my time, really. But I still used to love watching the reruns, and that was always very funny to me.
I remember watching... they used to repeat on a BBC Two while the news was on. There'd be black and white... They'd often put black and white films on, like Harold Lloyd was on. I used to love that. And
Yeah.
And also George Formby. I used to love George Formby movies when I was a kid. I mean, they were kind of light-hearted, but not for. But I remember just thinking he was brilliant, George Formby. I mean, if I watched them now, I'd probably be shocked.
yeah.
But they were, you know, at the time, I really loved them.
Yeah, and I'm talking about movies. I remember watching. This is quite an obscure one. Pee-wee's Big Adventure. Do you remember that? Pee-wee Herman?
I do, yeah.
And it was a very early Tim Burton film, and I remember loving that film.
Yeah,
All the classic 80s films. I should say I'm 10 years younger than Howard, so we've probably got different kind of comedic influences growing up, but some very much the same, like Morecambe and Wise, and, yeah, like you said, Howard, League of Gentlemen.
Yeah, of course. But, I mean, now, I've just finished watching Fleabag, and everything about it I wanted to... after hate, because for me it represents everything I hate, that kind of smug middle class cool people with their cool lives, you know, and I totally loved it. I think it's absolutely brilliant.
It is brilliant, isn't it?
And the kind of supplementary to that question is, what did you want to be when we grew up? It's really boring, actually. I only ever wanted to be an actor. That's all I ever wanted to do.
Boring, because that's what you are.
Yeah, I know. It's really dull.
How dull.
No, I didn't ever imagine I would do anything else. I mean, I did get... When I left drama school... when I left school, not drama school, I got a place on the National Council for Journalist Training course, which is actually really hard to get onto. And I got this place and I just turned it down because I realised that if I did that, I'd end up being a journalist. And I didn't want to be a journalist.
Well, I'd love to have read one of your articles, what they'd be like.
What about you?
I wanted to be... The first thing I remember wanting to be was a cartoonist. Because I used to love drawing pictures of mostly kind of weird, ugly faces when I was a kid. That was my thing. I'd draw weird faces. And I used to love sitting and doing that. And I used to think, if I could do this as a job, I'd be very happy. So, yeah, I wanted to be a cartoonist. And then that never really happened. And then for the next 12 years, I didn't want to be anything. I didn't even think about it. And then it was only when I started doing drama at school, I thought, hey, this is brilliant. This is what I want to be doing. So that's when I started to take it a bit more seriously. But cartoonist was the first thing I ever wanted to be. And I suppose in a way, Howard, I have turned into a cartoonist of sorts.
You definitely have.
I did a profound tone of voice then to make you think that I was saying something profound.
I liked it.
And in a way, he did.
Right, we've got two questions now, which I'm going to roll into one. This is from Angela McCall and Anna McBride. Angela says, I saw the Nativity in Salisbury and laughed so much I cried at the murder of the innocents. Reassembly must take a while, And then Anna McBride says, I'd like to know how many innocent dolls you've got through in your time performing the Nativity. Thanks.
You're welcome, Anna.
We'll take all those together. So Reassembly did take a while.
Yes. We had two methods of reassembling. One was we would reassemble the dolls directly after the performance. So when the audience were out, we'd come out and we'd find all the bits and we'd go, right, I've got a leg here. What have you got? Yeah. Well, I've got a torso. And we'd find them all and we'd reassemble them. I think we had like 17 dolls. We knew if we didn't have that many limbs, we'd had to look harder.
Yeah.
Or someone had taken some at home. We'd do that directly after the performance. Or sometimes we'd go, fuck it, let's not do it tonight. And we'd do it
the next day. Yeah, if we were at the shop and stuff, we'd do it the next day, wouldn't we? Because we knew that nobody was going to go in there and, and muck
but
about
that, with them. That approach, we differed on that because I was always a bit scared that if we didn't do it straight away and we turned up the next day, half an hour before the show or whatever, and we were missing one, then I'd start to panic because I had a very specifically timed spiel while I gave these dolls out. So for me, it had to be a very specific amount of dolls that I had.
I know. I don't think I ever quite got that.
No?
Well, I don't think I ever understood that was important to you. You know what I mean? I didn't think it was important. I don't think I ever really got how important that was to you. And I was always a bit kind of like, well, if he's only got 15, what does it matter? But you were right.
Yeah. Well, I'd have landed myself in trouble having either more words than actions or more actions than words. Yeah. So that always made me panic a little bit. But we did have a couple of spares, didn't we?
We did,
we've broken them or whatever.
They did break quite a lot, didn't they?
They did break quite a lot.
Like, but how many we got through? Probably only about 20, 22.
I think we had 17 in the show and we had a few spare. Yeah. So probably, just mid-20s.
But they were... We did the second time we did it, it was murder to find replacement dolls. So I don't know. If we do it again, I don't know what we'll do. Let's not talk about
it. I don't know. Yeah. But it also was quite a boring job, wasn't it, having to sit and reassemble
it? It really was,
just when you come down from a show, going sitting on the stage, putting some plastic dolls together before you go home. That was
really
boring.
Dull.
So, I hope that answers your question, Angela and Anna. Mm-hmm. Amanda Mary Foster... She's referring to the costume, the dress-up that we mentioned earlier. Should we get dressed up for the occasion of this podcast? I could disguise a Jack Russell as a sheep.
Well, I hope you have, Amanda.
I hope you have. And if you have disguised your Jack Russell as a sheep, we want to see pictorial evidence of that. Please post that photo to the comments of this when it goes live.
Or to Facebook or to Twitter.
Yeah.
David Phillips, this is not a question, it's just a comment, really. I love the nativity. Saw it both times. It came to Sturminster. The slaughter of the innocents will stay with me forever. And Herod's hat was a feast of engineering. Hats off to costume. the costumes were actually made by... We had these kind of smocks, didn't we? Kind of coverall smocks. Biblical-style smocks. And they were made by my lovely wife, Kirsten. She made those, didn't she?
She did.
And then the hat was made by Trimmo, our brilliant stage manager. It was the tallest crown that you could possibly imagine.
It was. It was a cardboard crown that went on and on and on and on. So when I came out, we should mention that the set for that show was just three sort of big bits of wood that hinged in the middle, and we were behind it. So I'd poke the crown over the top and I'd just keep going up and up and up and up until my face appeared. So that was quite a fun little bit. Mm. So thank you, David, for that. I'm looking forward to seeing what David says next week. He's got something to say every week, hasn't he, so far?
Well, we like it, David. We love it. We love it.
We do. So we've come to the end of the Living Spit podcast for this week on the Nativity. There's just one final item, listeners, and I know you've been waiting the whole show for this, as have I. Howard's End.
Howard's End is going to end the show for us. Howard's End.
There's the jingle. And over to you, Howard.
At this time of Easter, and at the time that we're thinking about the Nativity, be like our Lord Jesus Christ.
Oh, thank God.
Be kind.
Is that it?
Yeah, that's it, yeah.
Wow.
I don't... You see, I got an oh fucking hell in the middle of that, and I'm not sure...
It was just shock that you were actually doing that. Lord Jesus Christ.
I'm disappointed in you, Stuart. I thought, you know...
All I can do is apologise, both to you and... Oh, Lord Jesus Christ.
Yes. So if you've got any... I'm just going straight on now. If you've got any... We don't know what we're going to do next week. We don't know. We are going to do a podcast next week, but we're
not
sure...
We're going to keep doing them, whether anyone's listening or not.
We are thinking that we will talk about another show.
Yep.
So if you've got any preferences, then let us know via the Facebook or the feed here on Podbean or Twitter or Instagram or email us at... what's the email address?
Living Spit @mail.com.
That's right.
And also, just a reminder, if you have enjoyed this podcast, which we hope you have, we've got a GoFundMe page for donations. That just helps to make sure that we've got a theatre company to go to when all this is over. So please give generously to that. If you've liked this and enjoyed it, that's why we do it. So please give generously if you possibly can.
Great. And we'll talk to you all next week.
We certainly will. So goodbye, take care, and stay safe.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
This is the Living Spit Podcast. Welcome to the Living Spit Podcast. Listen to the Living Spit Podcast. It's on the way.